Juan Pablo hadn't returned to the canyon by the next morning, and Matt wasn't sure what that meant. He hoped that Sam and the Navajo hadn't run into trouble, such as another ambush attempt. Elizabeth Fleming wasn't in the Hogan when Matt woke up. He didn't see any point in asking the Navajo woman about her, so he had just kept quiet, eaten the bowl of stew she gave him for breakfast, and sat motionless while she changed the poultices on his wounds. He felt stronger now, and as a result, he was even more restless than before. That afternoon, it grew so warm and stuffy inside the Hogan that Matt felt like he couldn't get a breath of air. So he left the Hogan and stepped out into the sunlight. This was the first he had felt the sun in a long time. A week, maybe? Matt wasn't sure. Because of his injury, he had lost track of time. All he knew was that although the light was blinding to his eyes, the warmth of the sun on his skin felt wonderful and was very welcome.
Matt?
He turned and saw Elizabeth standing there. From the looks of it, she had been on her way around the Hogan when she saw him and stopped short in surprise. She took a step toward him and lifted a hand as if she intended to reach out and touch his bare chest. Other than the bandages wrapped around his midsection to hold the poultices in place, he was naked from the waist up. Plenty of people were around, including Juan Pablo's wife, who had followed Matt out of the Hogan. Feeling their eyes on him, he backed away from Elizabeth, then turned and pushed past the older woman to go back inside. His jaw was clenched in anger, most of it directed at himself. He had never in his life been one to run from trouble, and here he was, retreating. Not only that, as he turned away, he had caught a glimpse of the hurt that flared in Elizabeth's eyes. That ate at him as well, and he seethed inside with resentment for the unaccustomed awkwardness that had put the both of them in this position. That was a long day and an even longer night. Matt was restless and had trouble sleeping. The bullet hole still ached at times and itched at others, and he couldn't help but wonder how Elizabeth was doing tonight. Juan Pablo was bound to be back tomorrow with news of Sam, Matt told himself. But Juan Pablo didn't return the next day, which increased Matt's worries about his blood brother. More and more he wondered if Sam and Juan Pablo had been ambushed. The thought that Sam might be lying out there somewhere on the plains, wounded or even dead, gnawed at Matt's guts. His boredom at doing nothing but sitting around increased too. His wounds had closed up and were healing. Some of his strength had come back, and while he knew he wasn't in shape yet to do a lot of hard riding or fighting, he felt too good to waste his days in inactivity. Through sign language, he managed to tell Juan Pablo's wife that he wanted a shirt to replace his blood-soaked, bullet-torn one. She gave him a shirt made of soft, red-dyed wool that he slipped over his head.
I'm gonna take a walk.
When she stared at him uncomprehendingly, he pointed to himself and then made walking motions with his fingers. The woman shook her head, but Matt ignored her and stepped out of the Hogan. He hoped he wouldn't run into Elizabeth this time. He needed to get a little exercise. As he strolled along the creek and past some of the other Hogans, he was aware that he was being given a lot of curious looks. Several children ignored the sheep they were supposed to be watching and started following him. They tagged along with him until their mothers angrily called them back. Some of the men watched him warily. Even though Caballo Rojo had guaranteed his safety, having a white man around had to go against the grain for these people who had been rounded up, forced to walk hundreds of miles to Bosque Redondo, had kept there in captivity for years before they were allowed to return to their homeland. Matt made sure he didn't do anything that could be mistaken for belligerence. He gave everyone friendly nods and smiles. As he approached Caballo Rojo's Hogan, he spotted the clan leader striding toward him. He seemed to be bound on a specific errand, and Matt wondered if someone had gone to him and told him that the white man was wandering around the canyon. Caballo Rojo stopped in front of Matt. It had already become apparent that he understood more English than he had earlier let on.
Rest. Get stronger.
I'm already getting stronger, Chief. I need to move around now. I need to do something.
Rest.
I will. I give you my word. I'm just taking a stroll.
Caballo Rojo looked like he didn't approve of the idea, but he didn't try to force Matt back to Juan Pablo's Hogan. He stood there scowling as Matt walked over to the creek and continued following it. He would walk a little farther and then come back, he figured. After being shut up in that hogan for so long, the warmth of the sun and the interplay of light and shadow through the branches of the cottonwoods along the stream were very welcome. Matt hadn't gone very far when a bend of the creek and the thickening of the trees partially obscured the hogans. The voices belonged to women, and instantly the possibility that they might be bathing occurred to him. Matt was too much of a gentleman to spy on any female in a situation like that, so he swung around to head away from the spot. Then he recognized Elizabeth Fleming's voice, and that stopped him in his tracks.
Don't be a damn fool, Matt Bodine. You better just get away from here right now.
He would have, too, but just then the women pushed into view behind him. His head was turned just enough for him to catch the motion from the corner of his eye.
Matt?
He couldn't stop himself from looking around. When he did, he saw Elizabeth standing there with three young Navajo women. Their hair was wet, and their colorful blouses and skirts clung to their damp bodies. They had been bathing all right, and Matt was glad he hadn't stumbled onto that scene. At least they were clothed now.
Oh, sorry. Don't worry. I'll be moving on now.
You're feeling better?
Oh, yeah. I'm stronger now. Those bullet holes are healing. I felt like I needed to get out and move around some, but I'm going back to Juan Pablo's hogan now.
I'll walk with you.
Matt didn't think that was a very good idea, but he wasn't really strong enough to run away from her, so there was nothing he could do. Besides, that would have been rude. He didn't want to cause trouble, but he didn't want to hurt her feelings any more than he already had, either. The pounding heartbeat and slight shortness of breath, Matt felt, told him he had pushed his recuperating body just about as far as it wanted to be pushed right now.
When Juan Pablo comes back, I may have to go.
You're going to leave?
Yeah, I need to find Sam.
Matt had thought it might take a week for him to be strong enough to ride out on Sam's trail, but now he believed another 2 or 3 days ought to see him in good enough shape to leave. And that would sure simplify matters with Elizabeth, too. Best he put some distance between him and her, so she could go back to her teaching and not be distracted by him. If he was honest with himself, he had to admit that he didn't want to be distracted by her, either. Not as long as Sam was gone and the mystery of who had bushwhacked them and why still went unanswered. Getting caught in a gunfight was easier in a way than trying to navigate human emotions. They had gotten back to Juan Pablo's hogan. Elizabeth didn't make it any easier.
I wish you'd stay longer.
I'll see you later.
Matt.
I'm tired, Elizabeth. I need to rest.
Of course.
Matt ducked through the entrance before she could say anything else. The Navajo woman gave him a stern look when he came in, as if she were scolding him.
I know. Oh.
He sat down on the blankets, and as he did, he realized just how weary he really was. He stretched out on the soft, thick pile of blankets. It felt good, and before he knew it, he had closed his eyes and dozed off. Matt didn't know how long he had slept before he woke up to the sound of angry voices outside the hogan. He probably would have ignored it, but he recognized one of the voices as Elizabeth's. She looked angry and more than a little frightened as she tried to pull away from a man who had his hand clamped around her arm.
Hey! Let go of her, mister!
The Navajo released Elizabeth's arm, but as he did, he turned toward Matt. His hand dipped instead to the knife tucked behind the red sash at his waist. The warrior lunged at Matt. Instinct took over. Matt's left arm came up to block the thrust of the blade. At the same time, his fist smashed into the warrior's face. Pain jabbed through Matt as the move pulled at the healing bullet holes, but that was a lot better than standing there and letting the man sink the knife in his chest. As the warrior reeled back a step, Matt grabbed the wrist of his knife hand with both hands and wrenched on it. The knife slipped from his fingers. The warrior swung a left at Matt's head. Matt moved aside just enough to cause the blow to glance off his ear. It hurt anyway. Matt hooked a left of his own to the Navajo's jaw. He knew that the longer this fight lasted, the less chance he had.
Pino!
The man that Matt had been battling abruptly stepped back. The man's face was flushed and twisted with fury, but with a visible effort, he restrained himself from attacking Matt again. Caballo Rojo stalked up and planted himself between Matt and his opponent. For a moment, the chief shouted at the warrior. Then he turned to Matt.
White man, go back in hogan.
I didn't do anything. I was just protecting Miss Fleming. Elizabeth,
What in blazes is all this about, anyway?
The young women have been gossiping about us, Matt. Pino here thinks that I'm corrupting them by being here. Many of the Navajo harbor such resentment toward white people that they don't like me being here in the first place.
So he was trying to get you to leave?
Yes. And some of them think we should both go. But I won't leave. Not as long as I can help these people.
Whatever she was teaching them, Matt had his doubts about how much it really helped the Navajo. Even so, he wasn't going to stand by and let her be mistreated. On a practical level, however, there wasn't much he could do. A number of men had gathered, and from the way they were glaring at Matt, it was obvious whose side they were on. Outnumbered, weak, and wounded as he was, he couldn't stop Pino from doing whatever he wanted.
Go back in Hogan!
You're just gonna let him get away with it?
Caballo Rojo didn't budge. His face was hard as a rock as he pointed at the Hogan. Matt reined in the anger he felt boiling up inside him. He wouldn't be doing Elizabeth any good by getting himself killed, and Caballo Rojo looked just about riled up enough to go back on his word.
All right. But this is wrong.
Wrong for white man. Not wrong for Dine.
Sorry, Elizabeth.
I appreciate you trying to stand up for me, Mr. Bodine.
Maybe when I leave here, you ought to go with me.
No, I don't think so. As I told you, I intend to stay. But when you're gone, it...
She didn't have to finish what she was saying. When he was gone, then the young women of the clan wouldn't have anything to gossip about where he and Elizabeth were concerned. The trouble would probably blow over. Fine. If that was the way she wanted it, he could oblige her.
As soon as I'm strong enough to ride, I'll head out. I need to catch up to Sam anyway.
Of course.
With a last glare directed at Pino, Matt went into the Hogan. The canyon settled down as night fell. The brief ruckus between Matt and Pino seemed forgotten. Juan Pablo's wife gave Matt his supper as usual, and this time when she removed the poultices from his wounds, she didn't pack more in there. Instead, she simply covered the bullet holes with a thin layer of moss and bound it into place as a makeshift bandage. Matt took that to mean they thought he no longer needed the medicinal powers of the roots and herbs the woman had been using on him. His sleep was restless again that night. He couldn't stop thinking about Elizabeth and wondering how she was doing. He admired her determination, but questioned her good judgment. The next morning, he slipped on the wool shirt again and left the Hogan. Pablo's wife didn't even try to discourage him this time. He supposed she had given up on getting him to do what she wanted him to do. He didn't know where Pino's Hogan was, or he would have avoided it. He definitely didn't want to encounter Caballo Rojo this morning either, so he steered clear of the chief's Hogan and walked along the creek toward the mouth of the canyon instead. He wouldn't get too close to it, because he didn't want to alarm the guards posted there, but walking part of the way and then coming back would be good exercise for him. None of the Navajo tried to stop him, although he saw several of them watching him. He supposed they knew he wasn't a prisoner here, so he couldn't be trying to escape. When he came closer to the mouth of the canyon, he was able to see out over the vast sweep of the plains, and it looked mighty appealing to him. Matt stopped suddenly and frowned as he spotted something unusual out on the prairie. Several miles east of the canyon, a large cloud of dust rose into the morning sky. His first thought was that it might be coming from a cavalry patrol, but after watching the cloud for a few minutes, Matt decided it was unlikely so much dust would be kicked up by horseback riders. That looked more like the sort of dust cloud that would come from a herd of buffalo on the move, or a bunch of cattle being driven to market. Out here in this big, mostly empty country, only one of those things was a possibility. The closest buffalo herds were hundreds of miles away, in western Texas. There were some ranches in these parts, though, and the punchers who worked on them might be moving some cattle. Matt wished he was out there on a good horse, getting a close look at whatever was going on. He didn't have any particular reason for feeling that way, just curiosity and restlessness. He watched the dust cloud until it finally moved out of sight to the northwest. The wall of the canyon itself cut the cloud off from view. When he got back to the Hogan, he spoke to Juan Pablo's wife.
See, I'm doing better, getting stronger. I walked halfway out of the canyon and back. I'm fine.
Some of that was bravado on his part. He was pretty tired, but he was convinced that he was getting stronger with each passing day. Another couple of days, he told himself. Then maybe he could start thinking about riding out on Sam's trail, assuming that his blood brother hadn't returned by then.
Still no sign of Juan Pablo?
The woman ignored him and left the Hogan on some errand. Matt was starting to think that she understood more of what he said than she let on, but she didn't want him to know that. During the afternoon, Matt had stretched out on the blankets to take a nap, and he was asleep almost as soon as he closed his eyes. He slept lightly, though. That habit had kept him alive on more than one occasion. And like a wild animal, he had the ability to go from sleeping to being fully awake in an instant, which also came in handy. In this case, it allowed him to realize something was wrong as soon as a faint noise came to his ears, and his eyes popped open. Even in the middle of the day, the interior of the Hogan was dim and shadowy. Matt caught a glimpse of an indistinct figure looming over him. That was all it took for his muscles to burst into action and send him rolling to the side. At the same time, the intruder's arm swept down, driving a knife through the buffalo robes where Matt had been a split second earlier. Matt snapped a kick at the man and caught him in the side. The impact knocked the man across the Hogan, but he was able to hang on to his knife. As Matt started to scramble up, the intruder came at him again, slashing back and forth with the blade. Since Matt was still kneeling, he stayed low and threw himself forward in a diving tackle. The knife sliced through the air above his head as he caught the attacker around the knees, knocking him off his feet. Matt levered himself up to make a grab for the man's wrist. The knife had a brass ball at the end of the handle to keep a man's grip from slipping off it. The intruder smashed this ball against the side of Matt's head. Stunned, Matt fell to the side. His muscles refused to respond to his commands, and the intruder would need only a second to slash his throat from ear to ear. Amazingly, that didn't happen. As the world spun crazily around Matt, he realized that somehow he was still alive. He rolled onto his uninjured side, got an elbow under him, and lifted himself so he could raise his head and look around. He was alone in the Hogan. The knife-wielding intruder was gone. Matt was baffled why the man had fled instead of just killing him. The only explanation he could think of involved the involuntary cry the man had let out when Matt tackled him. The would-be assassin must have worried that he would draw attention to the Hogan and didn't want to be seen emerging from the dwelling where Matt's murdered body would be found later, so he'd abandoned his plan and gotten out quickly. That didn't mean he wouldn't try again to kill Matt later on. Matt sat up and took stock of himself. The bullet holes in his side hurt from all the activity, but as far as he could tell, they hadn't opened up and started bleeding again. He was still sitting there when a figure loomed in the doorway.
Matt, are you all right? Someone said they heard a shout from this Hogan, and then a man ran out.
That's right. Somebody snuck in here and tried to knife me.
Elizabeth hurried into the Hogan and dropped to her knees beside him. Juan Pablo's wife followed her. The older woman's usually stolid face actually wore a worried expression for a change.
Who in the world would try to do that?
I can only think of one fella I've had a run-in with lately.
You mean Pino?
He was ready to stick a knife in me earlier.
That was just a spur-of-the-moment thing because he was angry. I don't think Pino would deliberately murder anyone. He's one of the clan's spiritual leaders.
Well, who else would come after me like that?
I don't know.
Juan Pablo's wife went outside.
That's Caballo Rojo. He wants to know if everything is all right.
Not hardly.
Elizabeth took hold of his arm to help him get up. Matt started to shake her off, but he had to admit, having her there to lean on felt pretty good. When he was standing, she kept her hand on his arm. They found Caballo Rojo standing there with his arms crossed. Juan Pablo's wife had been talking to him.
I don't know what she told you, but someone snuck into the Hogan while I was dozing and tried to kill me.
Who would do this?
Well, I think it was Pino.
Not Pino. Pino is good man.
Well, I haven't had trouble with anybody else from your clan.
Not Pino.
The chief jerked his head in an indication that Matt and Elizabeth should follow him.
Come.
They exchanged a glance. Since they were both here because Caballo Rojo had extended his hospitality to them, they couldn't very well refuse. They followed the clan leader along the creek, past several of the other Hogans and the grazing herd of sheep. When they came to another Hogan, Matt wasn't surprised when Pino emerged from the dwelling. The man gave him and Elizabeth unfriendly looks, then spoke to Caballo Rojo in Navajo. When Pino was finished, Caballo Rojo turned to Matt.
Pino, here.
He made a flat, slashing motion with his hand.
All day.
Matt wanted to point out that Pino could be lying about that, even if the members of the man's family backed him up on that. They could be lying as well. But while Caballo Rojo might be a judge of sorts, this wasn't a court of law. No rules of evidence applied here. What Caballo Rojo believed was the only thing that mattered. And clearly, the clan leader was on Pino's side in this dispute. Anyway, to be absolutely honest about it, Matt hadn't gotten a good look at the intruder. All he could be sure of was that the man had been dressed like a Navajo, and Pino was hardly the only one in this canyon who fit that description.
All right. Maybe Pino didn't try to kill me, but somebody did.
Caballo Rojo shrugged, as if to say that wasn't his worry.
Fine. But I'll be sleeping with one eye open from now on. You can count on that.
Caballo Rojo turned away. Matt had the distinct impression that the clan leader was washing his hands of the whole matter. Pino glared at Matt and Elizabeth again and went back in his hogan, leaving the two of them alone.
I don't understand, Matt. Why would any of these people want to kill you? No one here even knew you until you were brought in wounded.
I don't have an answer. Maybe it'd be best if I just got on my horse and left.
You're in no shape to do that.
I'm in no shape to fight off whoever wants me dead, either. But if I could make it to Flat Rock and find Sam, he could watch my back.
You don't know if he's even there. He could have found the trail of those men who attacked you, and it could have led somewhere else.
She was right about that. But Matt's instincts told him there was some connection between the bushwhackers and the settlement. For one thing, the man who'd taken those potshots at him and Sam had been using repeaters. Judging by what he had seen so far, the Navajo didn't have any rifles except a few old single-shot weapons. Matt was convinced the bushwhackers had been white men. And where else in these parts would white men be found except in Flat Rock, or on one of the ranches in the area of the settlement?
I won't leave today. I reckon I'm still not strong enough to do that. But I don't make any promises about tomorrow.
You should come back to my hogan. I can watch over you and make sure nothing happens.
Matt wasn't sure a school teacher from Vermont would be able to stop somebody from trying to kill him. And besides...
Well, that'd just scandalize these folks even more. They'd run us both out of the canyon, and you didn't want to leave yet.
Maybe I've changed my mind. Things are getting too tense here. Normally, the Navajo are very peaceful people, but I'm starting to get a feeling that, well, that there might be trouble.
Matt looked up and down the canyon. He felt the same way. The hair on the back of his neck stood up and the skin prickled, as if someone were watching them. Somebody who didn't have their best interests in mind.
Tomorrow, if you still feel that way, we'll get out of here.
All right.
Now all they had to do was live through the night. Mrs. McCormick had told Sam that she served breakfast at 6 o'clock. What he found waiting for him when he came into the dining room the next morning was worth getting up that early for. The rich aroma of fresh-brewed coffee filled the room and mingled with other enticing smells, like that of fresh-baked bread and sizzling bacon. 6 men sat at the long table, including Noah Riley. The little bespectacled clerk lifted a hand in greeting and smiled at Sam.
Mr. Two Wolves, Mrs. McCormick told me you'd taken a room here. I'm glad to see you.
You too, Noah.
Riley pulled back the empty chair next to him.
Well, here, I have a seat.
The table was already set and had food on it. Sam saw platters full of bacon, biscuits, hotcakes, eggs, and hash brown potatoes. A couple of pots of coffee sat within easy reach, and so did a pitcher of buttermilk. There was gravy and honey for the biscuits, molasses for the hotcakes. It was classic boarding house fare, and Sam's stomach rumbled a little as he sat down next to Riley, letting him know that he was ready for it. Mrs. McCormick came in from the kitchen, carrying a tray with several jars of different jams and preserves on it.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Two Wolves. Have you met everyone?
No, not really. Just Noah here.
Well, let me introduce you to the other fellas. Josh Brown, Bill Johnson, Elliot Winters, Bob Campbell, and Cyrus Brimley. Well, now, you don't want to get too well acquainted with Cyrus here. Now, he's the undertaker.
Pleased to meet all of you.
Sam filed away the information in his head, knowing that he wouldn't remember most of it. The townsmen were all pleasant enough, although a couple of them were a little reticent in their greetings. Sam had a hunch that was because of his Cheyenne blood. Overall, though, it was a pleasant meal, and Sam was stuffed by the time he was finished. After breakfast, Riley walked out of the house with Sam.
What are your plans for the day, Sam?
I don't really have any.
Are you looking for work?
I might be.
He wasn't really, but he might have to use that as an excuse to hang around Flat Rock while he continued to search for the bushwhackers.
Unfortunately, I can't offer you a job. Mr. Wilmot, who lives in Prescott, owns the store, but entrusts the running of it completely to me. Right now, the profits don't justify hiring another employee.
That's all right, Noah. I don't think I was cut out to work in a store anyway.
That's true. It takes a certain type, a type such as me, doesn't it?
I didn't mean...
No. I'm perfectly aware that I'm not the adventurous of swashbuckling sort. I think most of the time people are foolish to try to be something they aren't. So I'm perfectly content to clerk in a store. It's what I'm cut out for.
Well, that's one way to look at it. I don't see how you stay as skinny as you do eating at Mrs. McCormick's.
The dear lady does set a good table, doesn't she? I guess I'm lucky that I'd burn it all off.
Now that the sun was up, Flat Rock was coming to life. Or at least as much life as this sleepy little settlement usually exhibited. A few pedestrians moved along the boardwalks, a couple of men on horseback made their way slowly along the street, and a wagon was parked in front of the general store. The doors of the livery stable were open, and that gave Sam an idea.
I'll see you later, Noah.
He walked over to Pedro Garolaga's place. The stableman was inside, tending to the animals in his charge. At this hour, the heat of the day hadn't started to build up yet, so inside the barn it was cool and shadowy.
Buenos dias, Señor Two Wolves. You are out and about early this morning.
I thought I'd go for a ride before the day gets too hot.
A ride? Where? What's there to see around here?
You never know. A man never stumbles over anything interesting if he doesn't look around.
There's not much anywhere in the four corners that's interesting. But suit yourself. You want me to saddle your horse?
No, I'll take care of it.
Sam passed the stalls where the mounts belonging to Stovepipe Stewart and Wilbur Coleman were kept. He'd halfway expected to run into the mysterious cowboys by now, since they seemed to turn up wherever he was. But so far, he hadn't seen any sign of them. Obviously, they were still in town, though, since their horses were here. Sam rode out of Flat Rock, heading south. He had only the vaguest idea of where the Devil's Pitchfork Ranch was, but he knew it lay south of the settlement. If he had told anyone he was heading for John Henry Boyd's spread, they probably would have advised him that he was loco. Boyd, Lowry, and the rest of the Devil's Pitchfork bunch had shady reputations to begin with, and now they were all stirred up because they believed the Navajo had killed two of their men and rustled 50 head of cattle. Sam didn't believe that, but he knew he was running a risk by riding on Boyd's range. If any of Boyd's men caught a glimpse of his coppery skin, they would probably shoot first and then figure out who he was. This trip served two purposes, though. Sam didn't want Caballo Rojo's people being blamed for something they didn't do. If the army was drawn into this, it would only make the trouble worse. The best way to avoid that was to find out what had really happened to the rustled cattle. Also, Sam was still trying to draw out the men who had attacked him and Matt. He couldn't give them a much more tempting target than this. Of course, that meant he was risking his life, but he thought that it was worth the gamble. He hoped so, anyway. If nothing else, the landscape was spectacular in its stark beauty. Dark, rugged mesas thrust up imposingly from the flat land around them, as did towering spires of red sandstone. Ranges of rocky hills bordered vast sweeps of empty ground. Colors faded from brown to tan to red to black. Sam's gaze roamed constantly over the country around him. Because of that, he was able to spot a thin line of smoke rising into the air a couple of miles ahead of him. That was probably smoke from a chimney, and a chimney meant the headquarters of the Devil's Pitchfork Ranch. So he was on Boyd's range now. Or rather, the range that Boyd claimed the use of. All this land was supposed to belong to the Navajo. Obviously, that didn't matter to some people. If the trouble between the white settlers and the Indians escalated to the point that the army was sent in, that would give the politicians back in Washington the excuse they needed to invalidate the treaty establishing the reservation. Sam had no doubt that they would do it, and that thought made him frown. He came to a pair of shallow hogback ridges about a mile apart. They ran roughly parallel for at least 2 miles, and the smoke rose at the far end of the valley they formed. Also at the far end of the valley, looming over it, was an odd, three-pronged rock spire. As Sam looked at it, he realized that it resembled, at least roughly, a pitchfork. That had to be where the ranch had gotten its name. There wasn't much grass in the valley, but there was some, and cattle grazed there. Sam reined in and sat there looking toward the far end of the valley. That was where Boyd's ranch house was located, and it was from this valley that the cattle had been stolen. He lifted his horse's reins, ready to start riding back and forth until he found the tracks that 50 head of stock must have left. Sam heeled his mount into a turn when he heard a bullet whip past his ear. He didn't know where the shot came from, but he could tell from the sound that it had been fired from a rifle. Sam continued pulling his horse into a turn and jammed his heels into the animal's flanks. Sam leaned forward over the horse's neck to make himself a smaller target. As he did so, he saw a puff of gun smoke spurt out from a spot about halfway up the ridge to his right. That was the direction he was headed. He was charging right toward the hidden bushwhacker. Then he spotted another jet of powder smoke from a different place on the ridge. There were at least two of them again. These would-be killers seemed to like working in pairs. Sam gritted his teeth. This was what he had wanted, to draw the bushwhackers into attacking him again. This time he intended to take one of them prisoner so he could get some answers. And to do that, he had to keep from being killed. He sent his horse plunging back and forth at zigzag angles to keep the rifleman from drawing a bead on him. His horse suddenly gave a wild leap underneath him. Sam knew the animal must have been hit. As he felt himself come out of the saddle, he kicked his feet free of the stirrups. He landed on his shoulder and rolled. Pain shot through him, but he ignored it as his momentum made him roll over a couple of times. He let it carry him up onto one knee and looked around for some cover. He knew he was going to need it. Sure enough, more slugs plowed into the ground around him. Several good-sized rocks lay a few yards to his right. As another slug burned past his ear, a desperate dive landed him among the rocks. He hugged the dirt. From up on that ridge, the bushwhackers could see down into this cluster of rocks. The area that was protected from their bullets was a tiny one. Sam made himself as small as possible and then tried to catch his breath. His left shoulder ached from falling on it. But he moved his arm around enough to know that nothing was broken, only bruised and battered. Even though he knew the range to the ridge was too great for a handgun, he felt better holding the revolver. If he stayed where he was, maybe sooner or later the bushwhackers would get tired of the standoff and come after him. That was when he would have his chance to use the Colt. On the other hand, if they were smart, they might just try to wait him out. The sun was climbing in the sky, and he didn't have any shade here. It wouldn't be too many hours before his position would become unbearably hot. Then his choice would be to leave his cover and probably get shot down, or stay there and bake. The rifle fire had stopped. Sam figured the two bushwhackers were up there on the ridge talking about the situation and trying to figure out what to do next. He wondered if the shots would draw any attention from the devil's pitchfork. The sound of them might have reached the ranch headquarters. But if the bushwhackers were two of John Henry Boyd's men, which Sam supposed was possible, then it wouldn't really matter. Sam lifted his head just enough to glance at the ridge.
Well, they're still up there.
Staying as low as possible, Sam turned his head to look for his horse. He didn't know how badly the animal had been wounded. To his relief, he saw the horse grazing on the hardy bunch grass about 100 yards away. A bloody streak on its hip showed where a bullet had creased it for the second time. Sam's gaze lingered on the butt of the Winchester that rode in a sheath, strapped under the left stirrup. He wished he had the rifle. Pinned down like he was, the Winchester wouldn't do him much good, but with it, the odds might not have seemed quite so overwhelming. He blinked as beads of sweat trickled down into his eyes. The heat was getting worse. Already his mouth felt like cotton. The shooting had stopped again. The bushwhackers were going to wait and let the sun do their work for them. Instinctively, Sam lowered his head even more, but after a second he realized that he didn't hear any bullets ricocheting off the rocks around him. Not only that, but these were pistol shots. They were coming from somewhere else on the ridge, and they weren't directed at him. Sam risked a look and caught a glimpse of two figures on horseback vanishing over the top of the ridge. They were moving fast, and the shots that still rang out hurried them on their way. Were those the bushwhackers? Or had whoever was trying to come to his aid been forced to flee? Either way, Sam knew this might be the only chance he had to get out of this trap. He leapt to his feet and broke into a long-legged sprint toward his horse. No bullets came searching for him. When he reached the horse, he yanked the Winchester from the saddle boot, worked the lever to throw around into the chamber, and whipped around toward the ridge, ready to return fire if any came his way. Silence had fallen over the valley again. Sam turned his head to look all around him, searching for any other sign of a threat. He didn't see any, but he didn't relax his vigilance. Movement on the ridge caught his eye. He picked out two riders working their way down the slope. They were too far away for him to make out any details, but something about them was familiar. When they reached the floor of the valley and rode toward him, he realized what it was. He recognized the two horses, a buckskin and a paint. That was Stovepipe Stewart and Wilbur Coleman riding toward him. From the looks of it, they had rescued him from the bushwhackers. But there had also been two bushwhackers. It was possible Stovepipe and Wilbur could have been the men he had seen retreating over the ridge. They could have pretended to flee, circled around, and be riding toward him now, intending to claim that they had saved his bacon. They were in rifle range now, so Sam brought the Winchester to his shoulder.
Hold it right there, you two!
Stovepipe and Wilbur reined in. Stovepipe leaned forward in the saddle with a puzzled frown on his craggy face.
Well, now, why in Hades are you pointing that rifle at us, Sam? It appears to me we just done you a mighty big favor, the sort that usually prompts a fella to say gracias instead of threatening to ventilate somebody.
I'm just trying to make sure I have everything sorted out the right way. What are you doing out here? Following me?
Yep, that's exactly what we were doing.
Why would you do that?
Stovepipe rested both hands on his saddle horn and grinned.
'Cause Wilbur and me, we got a hunch that you might be looking for the same fellas we are.
Sam was curious enough now that he lowered the rifle slightly.
Come on over here so we can talk easier. But don't try anything funny, because I'll be watching you.
We wouldn't dream of it.
They hitched their horses into motion again and rode slowly toward Sam. He kept the rifle pointed in their general direction and his finger ready on the trigger.
All right, stop there. Now dismount one at a time.
Stovepipe looked at Wilbur, who shrugged.
All right, I'll go first. Don't get trigger happy now, Sam.
The lanky cowboy swung down from the saddle. Holding onto his horse's reins with one hand, he raised the other hand to shoulder height.
See? Not trying anything funny.
Now you, Wilbur.
Wilbur dismounted and didn't make any threatening moves either. Once they were both on the ground, Sam lowered the rifle to his waist. He could still fire from the hip with blinding speed if he needed to.
What's this about us looking for the same men?
Well, in order to tell you about it, I'm going to have to ask you to believe a couple things we can't prove right now. The first being that we ain't who we seem to be.
You mean you're not a couple of drifting grubline riders? I had started to figure that out.
Truth of it is, we're lawmen. Sort of.
How can you sort of be lawmen?
We ain't federal marshals or rangers or even local badge toters. We're private operators, I reckon you could say. Range detectives. We work most of the time for the Cattlemen's Protective Association.
Sam knew about the CPA. It was a loose-knit organization with members stretching from Montana to the Rio Grande. In fact, he and Matt both belonged to it. That is, assuming their ranch managers had remembered to send in their dues, the Blood Brothers didn't keep track of such things.
If you work for the CPA, you ought to have papers showing that.
Well, see, that's why I said we couldn't prove it right now. We ain't exactly working for the CPA on this case. They've sort of loaned us out, you might say.
Loaned you out? To who? And what case are you talking about?
We're working for the War Department in Washington. Secret-like, which is why we got no bona fides on us saying who we are.
Are you sure we ought to be telling him all this, Stovepipe? For all we know, he could be part of the gang.
Then who was that shooting at him a while ago?
For what it's worth, that wasn't the first time somebody tried to bushwhack me. It's the third attempt in the past week, and I'm convinced that they were all by the same bunch.
Sounds like you've made yourself some powerful enemies, Sam.
Yeah, and I still don't have any idea why.
Oh, shoot, we can tell you that.
Stovepipe looked over at Wilbur again. The smaller man shrugged and nodded.
It's about two things, Sam. Money and guns.
You're going to have to explain that.
Yeah, I figured I'd have to. You see, about a month ago, a shipment of rifles, brand new trapdoor Springfields, were on their way to the garrison at Fort Defiance when the wagon they were in was waylaid. The troopers riding escort with the guns were wiped out.
Do the authorities believe that the Navajo did that?
Nope. One of the troopers was shot to pieces but lived long enough to talk to some freighters who came across the massacre. Before he died, he said it was white men who jumped him, and the shod hoof prints around the place indicated that too.
But just because it wasn't Indians who stole the rifles, that don't mean those guns won't wind up in Navajo hands before it's all said and done.
The Navajo are peaceful people. They've been mistreated, but despite that, all they want is to be left alone.
I ain't gonna argue with you about how they've been treated, but you're a mite too young to remember a Navajo headman named Manuelito. He wasn't a very peaceful fella. From what I've heard, even the other Navajo were a mite nervous around him. He gave Kit Carson a pretty good fight over in New Mexico territory a while back.
That was nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah, but there are still some firebrands among the Navajo who think the old boy had it right. They think trying to get along with the white men ain't worked out too well for their people, and it's way past time to start killing again.
Sam thought about Juan Pablo and the fierce resentment he felt toward the whites. It wouldn't take much to get him to be in favor of a new Navajo war, and there were bound to be others like him among the clans.
So you think whoever stole those rifles intends to sell them to the Navajo? That doesn't make any sense. What would they use to pay for them? Sheep? Blankets?
Didn't say nothing about anybody paying for those Springfields, but they could still wind up in Navajo hands, like Wilbur said.
Only if the thieves want to start a war.
Stovepipe shrugged. Those same thoughts had gone through Sam's mind earlier. Judging by what these two self-proclaimed range detectives were telling him, he had been on the right track. But he wanted to see if their thinking matched up with his.
Where does the money come in?
The money's to be made when somebody comes in and grabs all this reservation land, once the government rounds up the Navajo again and marches them back to Bosque Redondo or some other hellhole. This is the largest reservation in the whole blamed country. It ain't just in Arizona. It stretches over into New Mexico and up into Colorado and Utah as well. Millions and millions of acres. If they throw the whole thing open for settlement instead of just the isolated patches here and there, it'd be worth a fortune. Leastways it could be if there was a way to get water in here from the Colorado to the west and the Rio Grande to the east. Wouldn't be easy, but with a big enough payoff waiting for them, you can bet folks would figure out a way to do it.
It was a long speech, but everything Stovepipe said lined up with a theory that had formed in Sam's mind. He thought about the marks he and Juan Pablo had found on the ground at the base of that bluff where the first bushwhack attempt had been made.
The stolen rifles were in one wagon.
That's right. 12 crates with 40 guns in each one. Nearly 500 Springfields.
A crate with 40 rifles in it would be pretty heavy, wouldn't it?
I reckon so. I'm starting to get the feeling you know more than you're telling us, Sam. We've laid our cards on the table. Now it's your turn.
Sam had to make the decision whether to trust these two men. His instincts told him that they had been truthful with him, and the facts they had provided went a long way toward explaining everything that had happened over the past week or so.
All right. I think a friend of mine and I nearly stumbled right into those rifles being delivered to whoever they're intended for.
You're talking about Matt Bodine?
How do you know about Matt?
We've been working out here on the frontier for quite a while, mister. You reckon we never heard of Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves?
You were mixed up in that Joshua Shade business a while back. Reckon that varmint might not have ended up at the end of a hang rope where he belonged, if not for you two fellas.
Where is Bodine? He's not dead, is he?
Not that I know of, but he was wounded. And I had to leave him with somebody while I went looking for the men who bushwhacked us. I think that's tied in with those rifles you told me about.
So where's Bodine now?
With some Navajo about a day's ride northwest of here.
Stovepipe and Wilbur looked at each other again.
You better tell us the rest of it, Sam.
For the next 5 minutes, Sam did so, explaining how someone had opened fire on him and Matt, wounding Matt and leading to them being discovered by Caballo Rojo, Juan Pablo, and the rest of the Navajo.
I think the bushwhackers must have tried to kill us because we came along just as they were about to deliver the rifles to someone.
He told Stovepipe and Wilbur about the marks he had found on the ground at the base of the bluff.
Those were definitely wagon tracks I saw, and they looked like it was heavily loaded. and a crate full of Springfields would have left an impression on the ground like that, too. Huh. And I thought at first it was a coffin.
Not a coffin. But in the wrong hands, what was in it sure might fill a bunch of them.
I backtracked the bunch to Flat Rock. I think they must have gotten spooked and postponed the deal. They probably have the rifles hidden somewhere close to the settlement. The boss, whoever he is, put guards on the trail outside town to see if anybody followed them. When I did, they tried to kill me again.
And they trailed you out here today and tried again, more than likely.
And why did you follow me?
Just keeping an eye on you. To tell you the truth, we sort of thought you might attract trouble like a magnet, given your reputation for getting mixed up in things.
And we weren't completely convinced you weren't mixed up somehow with the gang we're looking for.
Now, you didn't have to go and tell them that.
Just like you didn't have to tell Lady Augusta that I like her.
So, when somebody tried to kill me, that convinced you I wasn't one of the gang?
I didn't figure they'd be shooting at you if you was one of them.
You know, if I had as many thoughts crammed into my head as Stovepipe does, I swear I'd go plumb crazy. That's why I mostly let him do the figuring.
And what I'm studying on now is, what brought you out here today, Sam? The hombres at the Devil's Pitchfork don't cotton much to strangers.
Especially ones with Indian blood. I know. But I got curious about those cattle that were stolen from out here. Boyd and Lowry blamed the rustling on the Navajo, but that just doesn't seem right to me. Caballo Rojo and his people are the closest ones to the settlement, and I spent enough time with them to know they wouldn't do such a thing.
Most of them probably wouldn't. But all it takes is a handful who take after Manuelito.
Maybe. But the whole idea is to increase the tension between the white settlers and the Navajo until a shooting war is inevitable. The men behind it are even going to give the Navajo those rifles to make it unavoidable, right?
Yeah, that's the way it looks to me.
So rustling the cattle and making it look like the Navajo are responsible would just up the stakes.
He's right, Stovepipe. I reckon he's about as good a detective as you are.
I never claimed to be no genius. What you say makes sense, Sam. The same bunch is playing the settlers and the Indians against each other to set up a land grab.
Stovepipe rubbed his beard-stubbled chin.
Question is, what are we gonna do about it?
The first step is to find out who they are. Maybe if we track those stolen cows, that will tell us something.
It sure might. All right if we mount up again? We've all decided to trust each other?
Sam slid his Winchester back in the saddle boot.
I think so. And we'll come closer getting to the bottom of this if we work together.
Sounds good to me.
All three of them swung up into their saddles. They started looking for the tracks left by the stolen herd.
You know, there's something that's bothering me. You said you left your partner Bodine with the Navajo, Sam?
That's right.
There's got to be at least a few members of that clan who are working with the gang that stole the rifles.
That same worry had started gnawing at the back of Sam's thoughts.
You're probably right. And if that's true, we might want to get rid of Matt just to make sure he doesn't stumble over what's really going on.
Yeah, and that means we'd better find the varmints we're looking for and bust up their plans as quick as we can. Because the longer your part spends with those engines, the more danger he's in.
Speaking of danger...
The other two men looked at Wilbur and saw him pointing toward the southern end of the valley.
Riders, coming fast. I'll bet it's John Henry Boyd and his bunch of gun throwers. And they ain't gonna be happy to find us here.
All three men reined in and turned their horses to face the oncoming riders. Wilbur moved his hand toward the gun on his hip.
Don't do it. There's too dang many of them.
Sam was already keeping his hands in plain sight, well away from his weapons. As the crew from the Devil's Pitchfork approached, they spread out so that they formed a half circle around Sam, Stovepipe, and Wilbur. That was menacing enough, and the expressions on the hard-bitten faces of the men were even more so. To a man, they looked like they wanted to whip out their six guns and start blazing away. Sam recognized the ugly, jut-jawed face of Pete Lowry. Lowry rode near the center of the group, and beside him was a man who carried himself in the saddle with such an air of command that he had to be John Henry Boyd. The two of them kept coming after their companions halted, not stopping until they were within 20 feet of Sam and the two range detectives. Then they reined to a stop as well.
Look at that, boss. We don't have to go looking for those damn rustlers after all. They've come to us.
Say, you've got that wrong, mister. We ain't rustlers.
Then who are you?
Boyd was an old man, with white hair under his black Stetson, and a face like worn, cracked saddle leather.
And what in blazes are you doing on my land?
Sam felt a flush of anger. This wasn't Boyd's land. And in the technical sense, it wasn't even open range, the sort of graze that hundreds of cattlemen across the frontier claimed. No, this was Navajo land. And the only reason Boyd was able to stake such a claim on it was that the authorities looked the other way, and probably had been paid off to do so. However, Sam wasn't here today to right that particular wrong.
We're looking for the rustlers too, Mr. Boyd. We want to find out what happened to your cattle and where they were taken.
Don't believe them, boss. These are the fellas we had that run-in with in town yesterday. The Redskin claims to be a Cheyenne breed, but I think he's a Navajo spy.
You blasted fool. You can tell by looking at him that he's not Navajo. Not all Indians look alike, you know.
That surprised Sam.
But that doesn't mean he's not a damned rustler anyway. A couple of white men and a Cheyenne breed can be owl hoots just like anybody else.
I never stole a cow in my life, and neither did Stovepipe.
And if we were the rustlers, what would we be doing back out here? Coming back to the scene of the crime would be kind of a darn fool thing to do, wouldn't it?
Not if you were looking for more stock to steal.
In broad daylight?
Then what are you doing here? I asked you before, and I don't intend to ask you again.
And I reckon we told you. We're looking for them rustled beeves.
What business is it of yours?
Sam glanced at Stovepipe and wondered what the man would say. He thought it would be a mistake to reveal their real identities to Boyd and the rest of the Devil's Pitchfork crew. For all he and his two companions knew, Boyd was behind the scheme to smuggle guns to the Navajo and start a new Indian war here in the Four Corners. Boyd already had a foothold here with his ranch. He would be in a good position to try to take over the rest of the region. Certainly, he and his men could have lied about the rustling, just to stir up the settlers in Flat Rock that much more. He shouldn't have worried about Stovepipe, Sam realized a second later.
Shoot, we figured there might be a reward, and we're getting a little short on funds. We thought you might be more inclined to give us some riding jobs, at the very least, if we found them cows for you.
That's what you thought, is it? But what I'm inclined to do is run the three of you off of my land. Either that or string you up.
That's what I'd do, boss.
I don't want to waste the time on either of those things, though. In fact, we've lollygagged around here enough.
Without warning, Boyd shucked his Colt from its holster and pointed it at Sam, Stovepipe, and Wilbur.
Drop your guns. You're coming with us.
Lowry looked as surprised as anybody.
John Henry, what are you doing? You can't trust these varmints.
I never said I trusted them. Why do you think I told them to drop their guns? I won't tell you that again, either.
I reckon we better do what the man says.
Stovepipe gave Sam and Wilbur a look that meant play along. Sam understood that well enough. He didn't see what else they could do right now. He had seen the muscles in Boyd's arm and shoulder tense before the rancher went for his gun. Sam was confident that he could have beaten Boyd to the draw if he had to. He might have been able to get the drop on the rancher and use him as a hostage to get past the other 15 men and the Devil's Pitchfork crew. But that wouldn't have gotten him any closer to the answers he was looking for. Sam carefully used his left hand to slide his Colt from its holster. He pitched the revolver to the ground, where it was joined by those belonging to Stovepipe and Wilbur.
Now the rifles. And I want that knife of yours too, Redskin.
Again, Sam swallowed the anger he felt. He leaned toward the opinion that Boyd and his men weren't the ones who had bushwhacked him and Matt. Since that bunch obviously wanted him dead, they would have gone ahead and opened fire as soon as they rode up. Sam and his friends would have put up a fight, but they couldn't have stopped the bunch from the Devil's Pitchfork from wiping them out. That didn't mean Boyd wasn't an arrogant, unpleasant son of a bitch, but maybe cooperating with the rancher would make it easier for them to find out what they wanted to know. For that reason, Sam drew his Bowie knife and tossed it to the ground as well.
Now back off, son.
When Sam, Stovepipe, and Wilbur had done that, Boyd jerked his head at a couple of his men, who dismounted and hurried forward to collect all the discarded hardware.
Come on. You want to find out what happened to those rustled cows, you said? Well, so do I. We'll follow the trail together.
I still think this is a bad idea, boss. They're part of that bunch, I tell you.
Well, if they are, we've got us some hostages, don't we?
Boyd led the pack toward the northwestern corner of the valley. Following the commanding gestures Pete Lowry made with his gun, Sam, Stovepipe, and Wilbur fell in just behind Boyd. The other hard-bitten gunmen of the Devil's Pitchfork crew kept them mostly surrounded. Stovepipe turned discreetly to Sam.
This is what we want.
We get to find out where those stolen cows went, and Boyd sees that we ain't rustlers.
That's what I thought.
Shut up, you two. I don't want you back here plotting behind the boss's back.
You know, you're a mighty touchy sort, mister. What happened? Did your ma take your favorite play pretty away from you when you were little?
Lowry lifted the revolver he still held.
I ought to bust your skull open.
Hey, that's enough!
The white-haired rancher looked back over his shoulder.
But I warn you, mister. Don't try my patience any more than it already is. If you do, I'm liable to turn Pete loose on you.
Sure, Wilbur here understands. Don't you, Wilbur?
I reckon.
Sam hoped that Wilbur would behave himself and not get them killed by potential allies. They already had more than enough enemies who would be happy to take care of that. Zach Jardine was on his way back to the Buckingham Palace Saloon. For the past half hour, Jardine had been talking to his partner in this enterprise, and the discussion hadn't gone very well, so he was in a bad mood to start with. His anger flared up even more at the sight of Braverman and Hilliard galloping into town. He had told the two men to keep an eye on that blasted half-breed and to finish him off if they got the chance. Now, from the way they were hurrying, Jardine figured that they had fouled up again some way.
What the hell's going on now?
It's that Redskin. He's gone out to the Devil's Pitchfork.
What? Why in blazes would he do that after the run-in he had with Lowry and that bunch the other day?
Well, it looked to us like he was trying to find the trail of those cows that got run off a couple nights ago.
God damn it. I hope you took care of him.
We tried, Zach. We really did.
But?
But those two drifters who sided with him in that saloon brawl showed up and came mighty close to parting our hair with lead. We had to get out of there while we still could.
Jardine glanced around to make sure no one else was within earshot.
You stupid sons of bitches. Now not only two wolves is out there poking around where he doesn't belong, but so are those two cowboys. I got a bad feeling about them.
It gets worse, boss. We were watching from a distance, and we saw Boyd and his crew come up and grab the Redskin and the other two.
They didn't kill two wolves and his friends?
No. They disarmed the three of them, but didn't hurt them as far as we could tell. Then the whole bunch rode off to the northwest, the same direction those boys took the cows.
Well, we figured all along that Boyd and his men would try to trail the herd. They won't be able to find it.
That's what that engine claimed, but we don't know that for sure.
Who knows those godforsaken canyons better than a Navajo?
But Boyd's got two wolves with him now. He's Cheyenne, but maybe he can track as well as a Navajo can.
Jardine took off his hat and ran his fingers through his thick black hair. The whole deal had seemed so simple at first. All they had to do was steal those rifles before the guns made it to Fort Defiance, deliver them to the hotheads among the Navajo who wanted war with the whites, stir up the settlers by rustling a few cattle and killing a couple of punchers, and then sit back and let nature take its course. When the fighting was all over, the Redskins would be herded out of the Four Corners, and Jardine would be ready to swoop in and take over. He scowled at Braverman and Hilliard as he recalled that if they hadn't been so trigger-happy a week earlier, maybe none of the problems that currently plagued him would have cropped up. That incident had fouled up the delivery of the rifles, and the plan still hadn't recovered yet from it. Now, this unlikely alliance between two wolves, those two mysterious cowboys, and the crew from the Devil's Pitchfork threatened to make things even worse. Jardine settled his hat back on his head.
There's only one thing we can do about it now. Angus, get a fresh horse and ride for the place where the cattle are being held as fast as you can. Warn the boys watching them that trouble may be on the way.
You really think I can get there before Boyd and the others do, boss?
I don't know, but you can damn well try. There's a good chance because you know where you're going and they don't. Now get a move on.
You want me to go with Angus, Zach?
No, he's a lot lighter than you. On a fresh horse, he can move pretty fast. Didn't you hear me, Braverman? Go!
Yes, sir.
Braverman pulled his horse around and headed for the livery stable to change mounts.
I'm sorry things didn't work out, boss. It's like that damn engine's got some sort of Redskin spirits looking out for him. Every time we think we're about to ventilate him, he gets out of it somehow.
Two wolves' luck can't last forever. And when it runs out, I hope I'm the one looking at him over the barrel of a gun.
50 cows and the half-dozen men pushing them along couldn't help but leave a lot of tracks. Unfortunately, even though there hadn't been any rain in this arid country in a long time, the wind blew and sometimes wiped out marks left in the dust. Not only that, but there were stretches of rocky ground as well where the hooves of cattle and unshod horses didn't leave any impressions. Because of those things, following the rustler's trail was more difficult than one might think it would be. However, Sam had anticipated that, so he wasn't surprised when the tracks disappeared about 5 miles northwest of the ranch, and the riders from the Devil's Pitchfork had to search for them again.
Why don't you let me have a look, Mr. Boyd?
The three prisoners were sitting their horses with Boyd, Lowry, and another man to guard them, while the rest of the Devil's Pitchfork hands rode back and forth across the range, looking for the trail.
Don't listen to him, boss. It's bound to be a trick of some sort.
What if he was to find the tracks of those rustlers?
Well, of course he might find them. I still say he's probably one of them. He already knows where they went.
Boyd looked at Sam.
I don't have any idea, but I'm pretty good at finding a trail, if I do say so myself.
So Stovepipe. He's got eyes like a hawk.
Better than a nose like a buzzard, I reckon.
Boyd frowned in thought as he rasped his fingers over the silvery stubble on his chin.
All right. If you think you can find the trail, have at it. But we'll be right behind you. And if you try anything funny, you'll wind up blasted out of the saddle quicker than you can blink.
No tricks. We want to find those cows as much as you do.
You know, I almost believe you. Which makes me wonder why you feel that way.
Because maybe then you'll realize that we're not your enemy, and neither are the Navajo.
What about those unshod hoof prints we found? What kind of white man would ride an unshod horse?
The kind who's trying to make everyone think he's an Indian. Come on.
After all that, Sam was going to feel like an utter fool if he couldn't find the trail. Less than 15 minutes had gone by, however, when he spotted a rock that was a little darker than the same sort of rocks scattered all around it. The stone had been turned over recently, and the burning sun hadn't had the chance to bleach as much color out of it. Sam reined in and swung down from his horse. He hunkered on his heels to study the ground.
You found something, Two Wolves?
Maybe.
Sam spotted another darker rock a few feet away, and another after that. He straightened and walked forward slowly, leading his horse. The signs were small, in some cases so tiny as to be almost invisible, but they were there. Sam followed them for a good 50 yards before he found an actual hoof print. It had been left by a cow, and he came across more and more of them as the ground became softer again.
Here. They came through here.
He lifted his arm and leveled it in a generally northwest direction, toward the area of buttes, ridges, and canyons where Caballo Rojo and his people lived.
And they went that way.
Sam hoped he wasn't wrong about the Navajo.
Huh. And then so will we.
Boyd slipped his revolver from its holster. He pointed the gun into the air, signaling his widespread riders to converge on him again.
You're leading the way now, Two Wolves.
Wait a minute. The Redskin might be leading us into a trap, boss.
I don't care if he is. We'll fight our way out of it. I want my cows back, and I want a shot at the mangy coyotes who killed my men.
At that moment, Sam almost felt some admiration for the crusty old cattleman. He could appreciate the loyalty Boyd felt toward the men who rode for the Devil's Pitchfork. The riders gathered, and the whole group struck out, again following the trail left by the stolen herd. Stovepipe brought his horse up alongside Sam's.
That was good tracking, son. Couldn't have done better myself, I reckon.
You don't fool me, Stovepipe. I'll bet you picked up some of the same sign I did.
Well, you was doing such a good job, I didn't see no need to get in your way.
So you let me take the credit with Boyd, so maybe he'll trust me a little more.
Credit's something I never cared over much about.
After another hour or so of following the trail, the riders began to get into an area that seemed a little familiar to Sam. Of course, most of the rugged landscape in the Four Corners region looked similar. The rock formations jutting up from the arid plains were infinite in their variety, however, and Sam began to see some he was sure he had seen before. That meant they were getting into the area where he and Matt had been bushwhacked. And that also meant they weren't far from the canyon where he had left Matt with Caballo Rojo's people. Elizabeth Fleming was there, too. Sam had spent a considerable amount of time wondering how his blood brother was doing, and that included wondering what was going on between Matt and Elizabeth. Sam didn't have any real romantic interest in the redheaded teacher himself, but he knew how Matt was any time he was around a pretty girl. Flirting came as naturally as gun handling to Matt Bodine. And Sam hoped that hadn't led to any trouble, while Matt was supposed to be recuperating from those bullet holes in his hide.